good to see me instead of Casey for a change. I hope that all of you are doing well this week. I hope your week's going great. I hope that the time that we've set aside at this time to open up our Bibles and to study another book of God's Word, I hope it's going to be beneficial for us. Casey is obviously not here tonight. He's going to be away preaching at another congregation, so he asked me to fill in, and I got on to him a little bit, and he took it. He was feeling a little bad about the book that we had made it to when he was going to be out, but I told him, you know what, it's good to study books that we don't always get to really study, so that's what we're going to be doing tonight. We're going to be studying the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs. And hopefully we can take a little bit from it, maybe that we've never thought about as we go through this book. Because if you're like me, this isn't a book that you normally jump to as a book that you want to go back and study. It's a very difficult book, and we'll get into that more as we go through this overview. But a few passages I want to remind us of before we even jump over to Song of Solomon, and that's 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16, which reminds us that all Scripture is given by the inspiration of God, and also Romans 15 and verse 4, which says that for whatever things were written before were written for our learning. And I read those two for the purpose of reminding us that even books as obscure and as sometimes tough to understand as this book is, we can find benefit in studying it. We can draw out some application, and we can also learn from Solomon here. So I hope that's what we're going to be doing. A few other facts about this book before we jump into reading it. It's interesting that nowhere in the book is God mentioned. Nowhere in the book is he talked about or referenced. He's not mentioned in this book at all. And also, it's never quoted in the New Testament. Usually, Jesus would go back and quote Old Testament scripture to prove points he was making and to show how he was a fulfillment and different things that pertain to his life was a fulfillment of scripture. Paul went back and did this. Other apostles did this. And yet, Song of Solomon was not one of those passages that was quoted in the New Testament. Those are two things I thought that were very interesting about this book. You can go ahead and be turning there. But before we even start here, turn to 1 Kings chapter 4 if you got your Bibles with you. 1 Kings chapter 4. What we're going to see is that this is the Song of Songs, as it's said in some translations, or the Song of Solomon. It's a play. It's a story that was written down by Solomon. And I want us to see first how many of these he put together. And we see that in 1 Kings chapter 4 in verse 32, where we're told that he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. So what we're told is the songs he wrote equaled 1,005 songs. Josh, can you see that on the camera? Okay, I wrote big enough. So 1,005 songs. And what we see from the title and from the first verse here in Song of Solomon is that it says, this is the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. That tells us that this is his number one hit. This is the one that stood out above them all. With all of these songs that he wrote, he was a wise man. There must have been some great things, some beautiful things that Solomon would have written down that we probably could have used in our lives, but this states that this is the number one. This is the greatest hit that Solomon has penned. And it's also an interesting note, too, that the reason why it said Song of Songs, the Hebrew language, the original Hebrew language, it didn't use adjectives. We never see adjectives in the original text. But instead, they would say words like this, Song of Songs, or we use the phrase King of Kings. We say this is that God is the greatest king amongst all other kings. He's the greatest. So we take away the adjectives and we use this idea of repeating and making one special, one above all others. So this is the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. It's written as a play. If you do not have the King James Version, which I found out recently that there is no division between who's speaking in this passage. I've always been used to reading the New King James, and it's always been given to me, well, here is the Shulamite speaking or the Beloved speaking. All translations do not delineate between those. But we do see that it is written as a play. It was written to be acted out. And there are different parts with different characters here in this text. It's very hard to understand in several different places. It's difficult to follow what's being talked about, even to old Jewish scholars. There was a Jewish scholar 100 years ago named Franz Delitzsch. He was an Old Testament scholar, and he made the comment back then that this book is by far the most obscure book in the Old Testament. And he would go on to talk about how the interpretations, there are many interpretations of this book, how each person might have many different interpretations. And really, truly, the key to understand this book was lost a long time ago. That's what he said hundreds of years ago, that key was lost. And it's too difficult to understand without that key. That's what the Jewish scholars would say. Now, here are a few beliefs about this book. And I don't want to dig too deep into them because I'd rather focus on how we can benefit from it. But we can learn a little bit. There are a few beliefs about this book. One of those, one being that it is an allegory. And I could be just like Casey. I might have misspelled that horribly. Are you normally the one that corrects them? Somebody could correct me. But it's either an allegory or some say it's literal. Okay, so that's the first argument, is an allegory being a story or a poem or a picture that always has an underlying hidden message. And if that was the case with Song of Solomon, in every verse we'd be able to go in and dig deep and find some hidden message that would teach us some moral lesson or some political lesson in some instances. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that what we have with the Song of Solomon is a literal a recording of a snapshot of Solomon's life. And what we see is that Solomon has fallen in love with this woman, and this woman loves Solomon, but there's some complications, and we'll get into that. But I believe it's a literal part of Solomon's history, whereas others believe that it might be metaphorical. It might not be truly a historical record, and I believe that isn't the case. The second thing, I'll just put it down here, is that there's a disagreement between if we have two main characters or three main characters. And that would be because, and some people will say that there's only two characters. It would be the Shulamite woman and Solomon, who is also the shepherd mentioned in multiple instances, or obviously for the three-character belief that Solomon and the shepherd are two different people. They're not the same. So there's these two different beliefs that really split people up. And then we also have some background characters that we'll see that really don't play a major part, but you'll see them referred to as the Daughters of Jerusalem. What we can put together is that was most likely the maidens that were not yet wives of Solomon, not yet his, but they were waiting. We'll see that in the middle of Song of Solomon, there are virgins who are waiting to be Solomon's, and that would most likely be these daughters of Jerusalem. There's also a relative in chapter 8 that's spoken of, most likely a relative of the Shulamite woman, and the Shulamite woman's brothers are mentioned. Those are really the main people that are spoken of in this book. Now, let's go ahead and get an overview. And we'll do my overview. I'll tell you, I've gone to several people in the past week just to get an idea of what others believe and why they believe it and how my belief kind of matches up with theirs. And it seems like every interpretation is different. And while that's the case, I believe that we can still have some semblance and some agreement on several parts of this book in which we can take some learning and some knowledge from so that we can apply these things. The first thing in the overview I want us to see is that there is a love between the Shulamite woman and Solomon, or the beloved, if you will. That's how it's described there. Like I said, if you're in the New King James, it's said that the beloved might be the one who's speaking. All right, and we see this starting in the very first chapter. In verse 2, the Shulamite woman is saying, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. Draw me away. She's saying to her beloved, I long for you. I miss you. I need to have you. And there's this strong love between them. Now, I want you to see before we get too far in that what I believe is happening is two different kinds of love. I believe on one hand, you have Solomon, whose love is purely sensual. Because what you'll see through most of this book is that Solomon over and over is complimenting the outward beauty of this woman. He's complimenting the external characteristics of this woman. And while the woman might comment on the characteristics of him, some, we don't get the same feel that that's what's driving her love for him. Very few passages does she talk about the specific physical characteristics that he has. Read with me starting in verse 5 here in chapter 1, and I want you to see the contrast here. She's going to be talking about a little bit of an insecurity that she has. She says in verse 5, I am dark, but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Now skip down to verse 8. Here's where the beloved talks back. It says, if you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. Listen here, I've compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. What he does here is he compliments her on her physical appearance. He compliments her on the attractiveness that he has towards her. And this is a very weird way to put it in our day and age, to compare her here in verse 9. My version says filly. But others might say mare. Basically, that would be a female horse. And I tell you, if I complimented Andrea today by calling her a female horse, things would not go well. Something would be thrown at me, I would imagine. But what he's saying here is I'm attracted to you because the horses back in Pharaoh's time were massive stallions. They were stallions that were to strike fear and to the people who would see them approaching. But what Pharaoh was known to do was he would take a young female horse and put it out in front. And all of those male horses would want to run after that female horse. And basically what he's saying is, I'm attracted to you just as those stallions were attracted to that mare, that female horse. And he begins to, from this point on, compliment her over and over on the external looks of this woman. Flip over to chapter 4 and look at the descriptions that are given here. Chapter 4 and verses 1 through 3, we see, well, really even further than that. He says, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have a dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like the flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. Your lips are like the strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate." And he goes on and on, getting even more graphic as he talks about this woman's body and how he is so attracted to this woman. And that's really the side that we see from Solomon towards the Shulamite. We see the same things written in chapter 4, verses 4 through 7, literally the same compliments and the same comments that he's making here in chapter 4 is in chapter 6. And then in chapter 7, the whole first section is Solomon saying, "Listen, this is what I love about you. This is what attracts me to you." But on the flip side, I think we see the Shulamite having more of a deep love for her beloved. And the fact that she's longing for him, she wants to be with him. It's not wholly central. Part of her wants to have that relationship with him, but it seems to be a much deeper relationship that she longs for. We see that in chapter 1, again, in verses 2 through 4 that we already read. In chapter 3 and verse 4, if you flip over to there, chapter 3 and verse 4, she says, "Scarcely I'd pass by them when I found the one I love. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him to the house of my mother and into the chamber of her who conceived me." She's longing for him. She's wanting to be with him. And we also see this in a dream that she has here in chapter 3 and also in chapter 5. Yes. Chapter 5. So we see throughout here that it's not always a sensual love and a sensual longing that she has, but also just a love that she has for this man. Now, there is one thing that I just mentioned. We have this. We have a love that's coming between these two people, but there's also doubt and a little bit of worry that you see. As I said, we have a section where the Shulamite woman is having nightmares. Flip over to chapter 3 here for a second. And at the very start of chapter 3, she says, "I'm on my bed, and I sought the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. I will rise now, I said, and go into the city and in the streets and in the squares. I will seek the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him." Now, eventually, in this nightmare she's having, she does find him. And like we just read, she holds on to him tight. She's thankful to have found him when at first she couldn't. Now, this is the first nightmare she has. But notice the second one. Here in chapter 5, in verse 2, she says that, "I sleep, but my heart is awake. And it is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew and my locks from the drops of night." And you skip down to verse 6. She says, "I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone." So again, she cannot find this man that she loves so much. And she continues here in verse 6, "I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but I gave no answer." Here we see that there's showingly some doubt in her mind about this relationship we has with him, because she's having nightmares. It's carrying over into her sleep. And you ask, well, why would she be worried? Why would there be worry between her and the king? And then you remember who this king is, right? We remember who Solomon was. If you turn back to 1 Kings chapter 11 just for a second, hold your place there in Song of Solomon. In 1 Kings chapter 11, we're given some information about Solomon that really says a lot about him and how he has strayed away from the Lord in this sense, that being how many wives he had, how many wives he took on, even though he was warned not to take wives from other nations. He couldn't help himself, and he went for them. That's 1 Kings chapter 11. That's what the first two verses talk about, how he goes after these other foreign women. But notice verse 3. It says, "And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned him, turned his heart away." What we see here is he had a total of what's said to be 1,000 women by his side, 700 of them being wives, women he'd married, 300 of them being women that he'd taken on, but they were also in that slave form. 1,000 total. And you say, well, that's not what God would have approved, which it wasn't. He was fully against it. It was a mistake that Solomon made over and over and over again. But here you say, well, maybe this was the one. Maybe he's writing this in a time where he's finally found his true love and she's the one where he quits. Well, we read that's not the case. In Song of Solomon, chapter 6 and verse 8, we see what stage of life that Solomon is in at this time. It says in verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. So we see as far as how many he ended with, as far as wives and concubines, he's very early in his life. He's early in his reign, most likely. So here's a man, and you have to put yourself into the Shulamite's shoes to understand she had every right to be worried. If this is how many wives and concubines she had, and how many other virgins were just there waiting to become his wife, she would be worried. She would have every right to be. And she would have every right to think, well, maybe he's not going to give me the attention he's given me now. And we see that. We might see an argument take place here in chapter 6, because at the end, in verse 13, the beloved Solomon at the end is saying, "Return, return, O Shulamite." So we see some distance, some separation between them. And he says, "Return, return, that we may look upon you." And notice the Shulamite's response. She says, "What would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of two camps?" What she says is, what am I compared to all these other women that you might have? And also, in the comment of the two camps, it might be her saying, you know, we're two completely different people. She started off by saying, I'm dark. That darkness shows that I'm a worker. I've been in the sun. I slave and I work hard. And you, Solomon, are in royalty. You have that lighter skin. We're in two different camps, she might have said. And we see some type of argument that might have taken place. But he's begging for her to return, and she gives that unsure response. As we come to the final chapter in this overview of what's going on between this, we see somewhat of a reuniting in the story. We see that they somehow have been reunited, because here in verses 11 through 13, she says, "Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field, let us lodge in the villages, let us get up early to the vineyards, let us see in the vine if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved." So we see a reuniting here at the end of chapter 7 and going through chapter 8 to the point where we see him being taken to her family's home. In verse 5 of chapter 8, a relative that we mentioned there at the start sees them coming and wonders who this woman is and who she has with them. And that we see the brothers there. So most likely that was her taking him home to her home. So overall, what this is this is a love story, a romantic story, and it can get as in detail as you want it to. As we said, there's very graphic portions that we're probably going to skip over tonight for time's sake. But the question is, how do we learn from this? And that's really the main thing I wanted to focus on for the rest of our time tonight with what few minutes we have left. And that is, what do I take from a book that is so obscure and so difficult at times to understand? So there are a few things I want to point out. What really stood out to me as I was reading through this, and I tell you, I've read this so many times, way more times in the past 24 hours than I have in a long time, trying to understand and trying to pull out things that I think we can learn and take and use, not only in our lives, but also teaching our kids and our grandkids. The first thing I think about is the Shulamite woman here is someone whose example we should follow. All right, we should follow this example, and I'm going to show you why, because she does a few things that we should have done already for those of us maybe who are married. And also for those who are not, she's someone to look forward to or look to as an example because she makes smart decisions. I think you'll see this with me. The first thing I want you to see is in chapter 1, the passage we already kind of brought up about her skin tone and how she might have been somewhat self-conscious about it. There might have been some insecurity there about it because she says to them, "Don't look at me," there in verse 6. "Don't look at my appearance." But notice in verse 5, she does say, "I am dark, but I'm lovely. I'm dark, but I'm lovely." And she also says in chapter 2, right after saying all these things, in chapter 2 and verse 1, notice what she says, "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." What I want us to see first that's beautiful about her is that while there might have been some insecurities about her external, and about the skin tone and about what it said to others, that didn't define how she saw herself. And I think that's something that really our young people need to know today, is that in a world where the external means so much, the external is what's going to get me to have all these friends, and it's going to get me to have these opportunities. I've got to look good. I've got to do what I can to improve the external. And this is both men and women. What we see here is that it wasn't the external that defined her. What she said was, "I'm the rose of Sharon." Sharon was a place that was known for having the most beautiful flowers, the most beautiful roses. And there, from what I've read, there were different kinds of roses at this place. But the best rose, the most beautiful rose of them all, the one that everyone wanted to see and the one that everyone wanted to have, was the rose of Sharon. The rose of Sharon stood out above all the rest. And what she says in this is that she's special. She saw herself as special, someone who stood out. And she said that, "I'm a lily of the valley." Again, the same concept, that I'm special, that I'm beautiful, even though I might have some of these insecurities. And I'll point out, too, that I didn't actually put this one in my notes, but as I'm thinking about it, what her skin tone told others is that she was a hard worker. So we could learn from her work ethic. We're told in chapter 1 that her family situation was that her brothers made her go out and do all the work. She was a hard worker, and because of that, she was tanned to the extent of being dark. And that really reflected her work ethic. So I think we could make a good point of, you know, she was not only someone who saw herself as beautiful, even though she might have had flaws, but she was also a hard worker. Another thing that I believe she points out, and I think even more important than the external looks idea, I want you to look at what she says in chapter 2 and verse 7. And she says this phrase this sentence three times throughout this book. And I believe we see it. If you go back and you read through the entire book and you see her attitude towards Solomon, a man who was just going after a woman and her looks, notice what she tells the daughters of Jerusalem. She looks around at these other maidens who are waiting to be with Solomon. And she says in verse 7 of chapter 2, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. I think this is one of the theme passages in my mind of this entire book. Because she says it not only here, she says it in chapter 3 and verse 7 or verse 5, and she also says it in chapter 8. She reminds these girls, don't stir up love until it pleases. And what I believe she's saying here is she's giving them motherly advice saying, make sure your love is more than just sensual, external love. Make sure that it is deeper. Make sure that it has time to ripen. Make sure that there is more substance and you get to know one another. She says, do not awaken that love until it pleases. She displays this mindset, as I already said, through this passage, through this book. Solomon, over and over again, this is what you look towards me. This is the things I love about you and your body. And what she keeps telling these women is, be patient. Be patient. And this is a lesson that I would hope that we're teaching our kids and grandkids. This is what I hope to teach my son and any other kids that I have, that there has to be substance in our relationships. They cannot be purely external. They cannot be, because in today's dating world, what we understand that instead of dating like the old days or courting like the old days, we don't say courting anymore, but I know that used to be the thing, right? Dating today is not the same, because what people in the world will say today is that a date could be jumping straight to that sensual activity, jumping straight to how you want it to be. That's what the world will push, and they'll push it on our kids, and it's up to us to make sure we teach them first before that message ever gets to them, to teach them what's right. And I think we can teach them this through the Shulamite woman. We can show our kids that, look at what the Shulamite woman taught these other maidens. Be patient. Be able to wait. Know when the time is right. Now, I believe we see where the Shulamite woman finally acts on those sensual desires at the end in chapter 7 verses 11 through 13 that we read. I believe this is where she finally says, I will give you my love. This is when it's going to happen. And she says at the end of the passage, I've laid these things up for you, given the idea that she's been storing up. She's been waiting through all of this relationship, and now she's finally doing it after she knows that it can be something that a relationship that pleases, as she said three times throughout this book. So I think that's an important lesson that we can learn, that we need to be ready to teach those around us, whether it's here in this building or in our homes. Be patient. Get to know. What really got me thinking about this, I was reading this two nights ago, and I had the TV playing in the background. And for those of you who might have Hulu, there are some commercials on there that just are, it's where our government's trying to force things down our throat. But there's a one thing on there that's all about the dating thing, and I think it's an online dating app. And they say specifically, dating has changed. And they said, if you're attracted to someone you don't even know, that's fine. Act on it. And what they're saying is, you just do whatever you feel like you want to do. And I guess I saw that, and then I came to this verse where, even like I said, in chapter 8 and verse 4, she says, do not stir up love. Don't jump to that point to where you move too fast. We understand that there is a proper place for that sensual love to take place, that being between a man and a woman who are married. And that really brings me to my second thought real quick, is that sensual desires are from God, okay? The desire to be with the opposite sex, that was given to us by God. But that desire had its confines. It was given to us to desire towards our mate, to our spouse, and not to just anyone and everyone that we come in contact with, as it seems that Solomon might have been doing in his life. And I tell you, sometimes the topic is awkward to talk about. Sometimes it's awkward to talk about the fact that God did give us these feelings that are okay to act on, as long as they're in the married relationship. And again, I think we see that towards the end of the book. In chapter, chapter 6, I believe, chapter 4. Well, that's where we see the bride and the bridegroom mentioned here, and the idea that maybe this is where their marriage takes place. Some people think it comes later, but with that said, I still believe the act, that sensual act, is still at the end of chapter 7, and we see that wait, the woman waiting for that moment. The last thing I want to point out that really stood out to me about this book is that it's just a sad story. Because as we've already pointed out, this is Solomon writing it. I believe that it's literal. I believe that this is a snapshot in his life. And we see him telling this woman, listen, you're the one. If you look in chapter 2, we mentioned chapter 1 or verse 1 in chapter 2 where she says, I'm the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. You remember that? Well, in verse 2, the beloved speaks back and says, like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. He says, you stand far above the rest. They are as thorns compared to you being my lily. And I see him saying there, you're the one. I found you. You are the one I'm going to be with. And yet we understand, as we've already pointed out, how the story ends. We go to 1 Kings. We see that he ended up with 700 wives, 300 concubines. This woman didn't fulfill that desire within him. It only gave me the same feeling, really, as Ecclesiastes did. As Casey talked about last week, Ecclesiastes is a very sad book because it talks about all of Solomon's failures, in the sense that he was chasing after all these things that didn't include God. He chased after money, he chased after women, he chased after possessions and power, and he got them, and he turned back after all of that and said, you know what, it wasn't even worth it. It was all vanity because God was lacking out of all those things. And I think this story is interesting because it follows up a sad story, and it is too a sad story. And looking at Solomon in this, when we have his account, I look at this wise man, and after reading these two books together, Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon, I hope that I'm, I guess, full of more content. I guess I hope I'm more content than Solomon was as he showed in these two books. A beautiful thing about Solomon was he was willing to write down his faults to really help us, to help those who would then come and read them and to say, listen, don't make the same mistakes that I made while I was on this earth. And one of those things is to be content with what you have. And I hope I have that. I hope that I can take a step back and say, you know, I'm blessed. I'm blessed right now. And I can say that before the end of my life gets here. Unlike Solomon showed there in Ecclesiastes. So here's what we have. We have a love story that we've gone over. We have, it's in the form of a play, in the form of a dramatic play. And while it's unclear in certain aspects, and while we might have different interpretations on different things, the fact is God placed it here. God placed it here, and we are told that all Scripture is given to us by God. And in the Old Testament, the things written of old are things that we can learn from. So I understand that I can learn some things from this. Now, the things that I went over tonight, the three things that really stood out to me, that's not all we can take from this. There are some certain analogies that I think we can take from this. Now, while I don't believe it's an allegory, I don't think it's an allegorical writing, I believe there might be some analogies we can make towards Christ and the church, and how there are some similarities. Also, the idea of the shepherd and how he takes care of his sheep, how the Shulamite describes him taking care of a sheep. But I think there are things that we can learn, and this isn't all of them. This is just the things that have stood out to me the past few days that I've been really trying to dig in and study it. With that said, I'm going to wrap up my overview, maybe just a little early. I don't know how long Casey normally goes, but I am interested. I did want to make sure to say I'm interested if you have a different approach to what you what I had given in my overview. Text me. I'd love to hear it. I love learning, and I look up to all of you, especially the ones here. I look up to all of you. You tell me what you think. I'm interested. And maybe we can have some discourse there and help one another as we try to study a book that's a little difficult. All right? We good? I hope y'all have a great rest of the week.